the help of what Moscow calls a pseudo-humanitarian group, the White Helmets, who it says is an arm of the terror. Stay with us as we take a look at the latest that's taking place in Syria. Well, we're going to start it off by crossing over to Damascus and getting the latest from Mohammed Ali. Mohammed Ali, tell me what you have on this story, the latest information.
Yes, according to Deputy Chief of the Russian Center for Reconciliation based at Hmeymim Air Base in Syria, Vadim Kolet, he said that they received information that terrorists of the Al-Nusra Front are planning for a provocation in the de-escalation zone of Idlib by carrying out a false flag chemical attack, and then they plan to accuse and blame the Syrian army for carrying out such a false flag chemical attack. Now, according to Kolet, he said that terrorists of the Al-Nusra Front, accompanied by members of the so-called White Helmets, transported 10 barrels of toxic substances to an area called Harem in Idlib over there in order to carry out this false flag chemical attack in the southern part of the Al-Zawiya mountain, also in the de-escalation zone of Idlib, and then accuse the Syrian army for such an attack. Of course, this is not the first time that Russia warns of such an attempt that terrorists are planning, of the Al-Nusra Front, of course, in Idlib. And according to many analysts, every time terrorists of the Al-Nusra Front feel or know that the Syrian army and its allies are preparing for an offensive to squash them in Idlib, they actually attempt to carry out such a false-flag chemical attack because they want to invite some kind of foreign intervention or international pressure that would lead to perhaps stopping such a military operation. Finally, previously, we used to see in Syria exit deals in which terrorists get out via buses and then the government controls that area. Terrorists go to Idlib. But now, terrorists have no other place to go after Idlib, so they know that they're going to be killed over there.
All right, thank you so much, Mohammed Ali, for giving us the update on the latest situation taking place there. I'm going to cross over now to Budapest. Welcome my next guest, George Zamudli, Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, and author of Bombs for Peace. Thank you so much for being with us. Are you surprised? I mean, we're seeing the same MO being replayed time and time again. Your assessment of this, are you surprised at this repeat of this scenario?
No, not surprised in the slightest. As you say, we had this same scenario in 2017 and in 2018, and the Trump administration took the bait and launched bombings attacks. We know for certain that both of them were absolutely fake. The Syrian government was not responsible for the chemical weapons attack, and there is no reason, there was never any reason anymore that there was a reason in 2013 in Ghouta for the Syrian government to use chemical weapons when essentially it has won the war. So therefore, the only purpose of creating these incidents is to justify a U.S. Military intervention, a U.S. attacks against the Syrian government. And I'm afraid that it's quite possible that this will happen. We've already seen that the Biden administration has twice bombed Syria. And I would fully expect that if such a situation occurred again, that the Biden administration would take the bait and bomb Syrian government positions.
Well, let me turn to London. Welcome my next guest to Spotlight, Dr. Markos Papadopoulos, historian and analyst, author of the new book, Arise, Russia, The Return of Russia to World Politics. Thank you so much for being with us. Now, I want to look at Moscow has blamed the terrorist group's foreign handlers for these acts. Let's talk about, in your perspective, your analysis of all of this, the biggest supporters of the terror and instability still in Syria are which players?
Well, there's no question about it that the terrorists in Syria, specifically Al-Qaeda and ISIS, would not have been the potent force that they once were during the Syrian conflict without the assistance of major powers in the world. And those major powers are many, but in particular they are as follows: America, Britain, France, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. The terrorists, for a number of years during the Syrian conflict, advanced deeply into Syrian territory, conquering a number of Syrian cities, but in particular conquering many Syrian towns, many Syrian villages. And the Syrian armed forces, which have been for decades now one of the best trained, one of the best equipped, and one of the best led in the Middle East, were faced with a deadly challenge from those terrorist groups. Therefore, it is simply inconceivable that those terrorist groups had been able to advance and deliver some very grievous blows to the Syrian army without the assistance of first-rate powers in the world. So, as I said moments ago, without the support of major powers in the world, and I would say most importantly of all, America and Britain, ISIS and Al-Qaeda would never have been the potent force that they once were in the Syrian conflict. And secondly, they never would have been able to inflict the grievous blows on the Syrian army that they once did. And they would never have been able to occupy the amount of Syrian territory that they once did.
Okay, well, George, now there was a chemical attack in Douma, Damascus suburb, and rebel-held area in 2018. The United States and the United Kingdom blamed the Syrian government for the attack and initiated airstrikes against government targets. Now, the Organization of Prohibited Chemical Weapons investigated, and as you know, there was much controversy internally with disagreements with the inspectors and even reports of cover-up. I want to talk about the importance of all this, the role the OPCW is playing actually in perhaps helping the terrorists, because we saw even some of the inspectors trying to come out and say they disagreed with the report, but basically they were shut down.
Yes, you've summarized it perfectly. That's exactly what happened. The actual inspectors who went to Douma did not find any evidence of the use of chemical weapons, and they wrote that in their report. But of course, this was not acceptable to the bureaucracy of OPCW that relies on the United States and the United Kingdom and the rest of them. And so they rewrote the report, but essentially completely falsifying the findings of the actual inspectors, the actual experts. So that's why there is no way that, if there is a chemical weapons attack, and the OPCW again sends in their inspectors, there's absolutely no reason why we should believe in any way anything that the OPCW finds. And you're absolutely right. They do serve as the enablers of the terrorists because they're there then to scream, oh, yeah, Syria used these terrible chemical weapons, and therefore then the United States and the United Kingdom can then triumphantly say, well, we have no choice but to act. So I think this is it's a great danger. But there is also a drumbeat that's going on right now. As you probably know, there was a debate at the United Nations Security Council about opening up additional border crossings to get, quote, humanitarian aid, unquote, into Idlib. So you can see that there is a kind of Western propaganda drumbeat taking place right now in Idlib, and that's why I think this is a very dangerous situation.
Well, Marcus, what about that? I mean, George just talked about this, the discussion in the United Nations about opening, as he said, so-called humanitarian corridor. Now, I want to talk about the role of these so-called international organizations and what has been happening in Syria. I mean, it seems as if what they have been doing is basically in support of these neoliberal regimes instead of being actually a player to try to control the situation and de-escalate. Your take.
Well, whilst the creation of the United Nations was an honorable and admirable one, the problem is not the United Nations per se. The problem lies with certain members of the United Nations who abuse bodies of the United Nations and mechanisms of the United Nations. And again, the two principal offenders are America and Britain. Washington and London use their immense global clout, both political, economic, military, and cultural clout, to penetrate bodies of the United Nations in order to use them as tools of Western foreign policy objectives. So I do not believe that there is a problem per se with the United Nations. The problem, as I said moments ago, lies with certain powerful countries in the world who abuse their membership of the UN to pursue their foreign policy objectives. And in the case of Syria, we see how Washington and London have unashamedly used the United Nations to provide cover for the terrorists in Syria, both Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The way in which the Americans and the British have used the United Nations to portray the so-called freedom fighters in Syria is really quite sickening, and it goes to show once again how the old maxim is correct: might is right. Because the Americans and the British know very well whom they are supporting in Syria. They know that the groups they are supporting are Wahhabist groups, who are essentially ideologically the same people who carried out the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington in 2001, and in London in 2005 and in 2017, and in Bali, and so on and so on.
Okay.
But of course, those terrorist groups are potent weapons of the Americans and the British, and they have used them in many conflicts, not just the Syrian one, but the Bosnian one too.
George, your take on what Marcus has said, and if you agree with what he's saying, I mean, what exactly does that mean? The same terrorist that has caused havoc in various Western cities, it's the same group that then these same capitals, London and Washington, are actually supporting in Syria. So what is it that the United States and the United Kingdom, what's the goal? What are they really after?
Well, the goal is regime change. And these terrorists, whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda, are very useful to effect regime change. I mean, either they can wage a war ad infinitum, they can just debilitate a country and drain them, as it looked like it would happen in Syria before Russia made its very significant intervention in the fall of 2015, which arrested the progress of these jihadi terrorists. So either that, or via these staged incidents, and therefore, which again then justify Western intervention. But of course, the longer these wars continue, then the longer or the greater the imperative within the Western capitals to continually apply further and further pressure against, for example, in this case, the Syrian government via sanctions, because of course the Syrian government gets blamed for the war, gets blamed for the atrocities, gets blamed for everything that's gone wrong in Syria, and so therefore that serves to justify the horrific sanctions regime imposed by the United States and the European Union. And Marcus is absolutely right. There's no secret that the United States used ISIS in Syria and in Iraq. And we have John Kerry's confession on this score. We have Joe Biden's confession on this score. They're open about it. They use ISIS in order to topple Bashar al-Assad. It failed. They also used ISIS to effect a regime change in Iraq, because the person was then prime minister. The Americans didn't care for him. So that's what happened. And Marcus is right. This was they did this same thing in Bosnia, mm-hmm. and which then served, again, there were all these sudden atrocities which always happened in the same place, and particularly at crucial moments in the war,
okay.
and then which
okay.
then served the justification for NATO military intervention.
Well, Marcus, now, Russia's previously talked about the role of the white helmets, this so-called, as they're talking about and presenting themselves as a humanitarian group, but Russia's talked about them serving actually the terrorist cells in Syria. I want to talk about the role of the white helmets in this and how they're getting away with really not even being condemned, not even being examined by the so-called mainstream media. Your take on this?
British state propaganda is formidable, and in my opinion, it is the foremost propaganda outlet in the world, and I would also say in recent times. And the White Helmets is just one example of that. The White Helmets, far from being a humanitarian organization, is nothing more than a propaganda outfit created and financed by the British state, not Britain, by the British state. The two are very different entities, created and financed by the British state to depict the Syrian government in the most awful of manners as a justification for supporting the so-called freedom fighters in Syria and as a justification for the economic sanctions imposed by America and the European Union on the Syrian government. Now, the White Helmets, the creation of the White Helmet, has been exceedingly successful in that it has convinced a great many people, in particular in the Western world, that this organization is a humanitarian one. However, it is quite easy to punch holes and large holes in the image which is projected by London of the White Helmets. So, for instance, why is it that the White Helmets, who purport to be a humanitarian organization serving the Syrian people, only operate in territories controlled by either ISIS or Al-Qaeda? If they were an organization serving humanitarian purposes in Syria, then they would be all over Syria. They would be in parts controlled by the Syrian government and in parts controlled by ISIS or Al-Qaeda. But they never have been in areas controlled by the Syrian government. So it is a very simple situation in which we find that the White Helmet is but a tool of the British state to further the objective of London and Washington in Syria, namely the overthrow of the Syrian government, the destruction of the Syrian state, the creation of a new Syrian state, which would be subservient to the West and compliant with Israel.
All right. Well, George, really quickly, 30 seconds, where do you see this going? What is it going to take to actually bring peace to Syria again and these Western regimes to accept their losses? We've just seen the Syrian people vote in a presidential election. What is it going to take to end the chaos there?
Well, you may not like the answer. My own feeling is that the only way that you can bring about peace in Syria is if the Syrian government, with the assistance of the Russians, makes the final move for Idlib and bring the Idlib under Syrian government control and finally rid the country of this Al-Qaeda.
Now okay, and on that note, I have to thank you both. So sorry, we're out of time. I appreciate you being both being with us. Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos, historian and analyst, author of the new book, Arise, Russia, The Rise of Russia to World Politics, out of London, and George Samutli, senior research fellow, Global Policy Institute, author, Bombs for Peace, out of Budapest. Thank you so much for joining me right here on Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light. Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint,
a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my dear guest, as always, Brother Hussein. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program again.
Wa alaikum salam.
And Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we were talking about the movie Andover in the last episode, and hopefully we're going to finish talking about it or discussing the issues and the messages of the movie and the consequences that it may in fact raise. Let me start with you, Sayyid Abdullah. You know, in psychology, we say that there are some people who are in such a way that they can't accept shocks.
Mm-hmm.
Shocks such as like the loss of dear ones, their mother, their father, their children, their wife, their spouse, you know, and they reject it for a while. All right. Here in this movie, well, cloning is an option which is available at the time of the movie. So The genetic professor in this movie comes up finally or makes his decision to clone his wife. But something we know in the process goes wrong and we know the story. Right? But what can a person do? Because obviously we don't have cloning as an option today. Mm. Right? So we are not living in this movie Andover, and we don't have cloning as an option. So what can a person do at the time of crises like these?
Okay, well, such a question should be directed to a psychologist,
yes.
A therapist. But from our intake is that we do say that time heals all wounds, right?
Yes.
So like you said, sometimes when you're faced with a shock,
mm-hmm.
Our bodies either get stuck either in a flight or fright system,
yes.
Moment, whether should I panic or should I just run away, right? So we have that kind of, that happens to us. Like all the psychologists and therapists and stuff like that, when
mm-hmm.
it comes to special loss of a loved one, they always emphasize on the fact that you need to have support, right? Like family support, people to be around you, people to support you through this very harsh process. I remember even in schools, sometimes when one of the classmates dies,
mm-hmm.
the whole school goes under lockdown. Like I remember a guy died and like they brought like a psychologist for each one of us, right?
Mm.
To make sure that we're not affected.
How old were you then?
I was, I don't know, like 15, 16.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even I was old enough, but yeah. Still, they take it seriously,
yes.
Right? Or you lose a pet, for example. They
yes.
take it seriously, depending on the country you're in, mm-hmm. obviously. So they, where I come from, they take mental health very seriously.
I see.
It's extremely serious. Because it's a serious matter that not a lot of people, put an emphasis on. So you need that support system to begin with,
mm-hmm.
to get you through that period.
Yes.
Someone to stay with you, to hold your hands, I don't know, to comfort you, give you that comfort, make you feel that you're not alone, especially like losing a loved one.
Exactly.
And so this is on the outside. And then you need to work on the inside as well. Ibn Allah in the Quran, he does not override this fact that you will be in a shock. Right? This is الَّذِينَ أَصَابَتْهُ مُصِيبَةٌ قَالُوا إِنَّ اللَّهَ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. Allah says, yes, you will be subjected to a problem, a calamity. You will
mm-hmm.
be affected. It would have an effect on you.
Yes.
But if you look at it from God's way, like, you know what? He is the creation of God. He returned back to his Lord.
Yes.
So you need to have that submission, that belief system with it. Then Allah says, then Allah will give you a reward. You know, the ayah continues as, قَالُنَّ اللَّهُ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. ulaika, and then Allah says, you know, he gives them this and that, right? So if you need to challenge your mind and have that support on the outside, you should be okay. But let's assume that you're someone who doesn't have both. If you're an atheist, for example, you don't believe in God, then that's one gone from you, because sometimes our belief, it's what gives us the comfort.
Yes, right?
I know he's going to God, and then I have to deal with what? The suffering of losing a loved one, and then
so
I
this
could
is one of the advantages of being religious,
of
basically.
Of course, and even atheists and anyone who doesn't believe in God, at the end of the day, they find, like, they have to come to their mind to find comfort and solace somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So they say, well, there is no God, but then they, you know, attach themselves to something else.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we call even God itself, because maybe you give it a different name, maybe. Let's use Star Wars, for example. Let's call it the Force. But in fact, you know, it's God at the end of the day. So you find attachment to that. So if you don't have that belief system, obviously you're losing something. So the pain on you would be even a lot higher.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd have, you know, a lot of people like in life, those who like are very attached, either end up doing a lot of drugs, doing a lot of alcohol,
mm-hmm.
or overdosing. Sometimes, you know, they end up killing themselves,
yes.
and so on. If you're a believer, though, that is not there.
Yeah.
You find the comfort in your mind, in your belief, and you have the comfort on the outside.
Okay, thank you. Let me jump in and take a break here, and we'll be back continuing this discussion.
We have to shorten the telomeres.
Very good.
And then stimulate the endocrine system.
Excellent. Emma?
Then we should increase the somatotropin level.
All while simultaneously manipulating her thyroid, parathyroid, and ovaries.
Her ovaries?
Okay. Before we get started, there's something you need to know. The work that we're going to be doing is, how shall I put this, ethically ambiguous.
I don't have a problem with that.
No?
On the road to progress. Ethics are like broken glass.
Great. Let's get to work.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my dear guest is still sitting in the studio with me, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Brother Hussein, we were talking about this movie, Andover, and this genetic professor, in fact, decides to clone his wife. As I was raising this question in the earlier part of this episode to Sayyid Abdullah, you know, we religious people, in fact, somehow resort to God and to something which is religious to give us this comfort, all right, after something as terrible as the death of a person that we love, in fact, happens. What do you think happens to atheists here? Do you think they have other options, or this might somehow change him in one way or another?
Okay, so let's step back a little bit. With any person with who belongs to any religion, even atheists,
mm-hmm.
They go through this thing called the five stages of grief,
mm-hmm.
Especially when they lose someone. So you have denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then at the end, acceptance. Let's jump right to bargaining. So what bargaining is according to an article by Healthline, it says during grief, you may feel vulnerable and helpless.
Mm-hmm.
In those moments of intense emotions, it's uncommon to look for ways to regain control or to want to feel like you can affect the outcome of the event. Okay, in the bargaining stage of grief, you may find yourself creating a lot of what if and if only statements, okay? And they usually means that you're trying to gain control again over your life. You're trying to find something else to turn to. So in the case of this this professor, what he has found is that he can maybe retrieve his wife. Maybe he can reverse what happened in a way and bring his wife back using the cloning process.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, with atheists, I guess, there are many different ways that they can distract themselves or replace the thing that they've loved and they had lost.
Yeah, but some of them are prohibited by the religion, by God.
Yeah.
Right? The kind of look that Sayyid Abdullah was trying to, in fact, get across, that idea that we religious people have, you know, we sort of think that we are God's creation and we are living in this world. He created us, and whenever he wants, he takes
can take
away.
Us back, yeah.
Yeah, he takes back that thing that he created or he gave us. All right?
Yeah.
So this somehow mentality gives us a kind of, let's say, comfort?
Yes. It gives us grace because we know that whatever happens, we're in God's hands. But in the case of atheists, for example, they know that death is inevitable. Mm-hmm. And it might come as a shock, but they know that it's something that's going to happen. And then, you know, lights out.
Yes.
But, you know, unlike religious people who believe that, you know, we go back to God. Whatever happens, we're in God's hands. So in this case, what an atheist would do, for example, might be as extreme as committing suicide.
Yes.
Or like Brother Abdullah said, they can use drugs or find different.
Yes.
Means to distract themselves.
But even the process of burial might give us some soothing, some comforting, right? You know, there are some verses of, for example, whether you're a Christian or you're Muslim, some of these verses are read by a priest or by...
Yeah, with an atheist, there are really no boundaries, like you're trying to say. With an atheist, like, they want to be burned or buried in a very, religious way. It's really their choice. And
yes.
For most of them, I feel like it doesn't really matter. Because, you know, at the end of the day, like I said, it's inevitable. So whichever way they want to be remembered, it's really their choice.
Let's take a break and we'll be back continuing our discussion on this movie Andover.
Careful, it's hot.
Okay.
And dangerous.
Okay.
I don't want it to blow up in your face.
Hey, I get it.
I would just hate for you to hurt yourself.
Then why are you making me do this?
Like an artist molds a vase, we could shape undifferentiated embryonic cells into skin, cartilage, blood tissue. We could treat diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. We could replace limbs and body parts. I know people hear cloning and think, oh, it devalues life. But no, the reason to do this is because we hold life in such high regard.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, the host of this program, and our dear distinguished guest, Sayyid Abdullah, and also Brother Hussein. We were talking about the movie Andover, a 2018 American science fiction romantic movie. Well, Sayyid Abdullah, I remember talking to a couple of professors from Paderborn University,
mm-hmm.
Germany, and they were Christian, and they were talking about a very important point that happens to some of the Western big cities, mega cities.
Okay.
Like, you know, they were talking about basically the German cities, Germany being like one of those extreme cases that you can see that people live their own separate lives. You know, it's not like the Eastern countries normally, even regardless of their religion. That you find out that people are more emotional here or emotionally attached to the things that they see or love.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying that the Germans don't love. No, this is not the point I'm trying to make. I'm saying that they were talking about this kind of loneliness that some people feel in the West. And especially their independence, their independent lives going on in different separate ways, that happens or that causes, let's say, some families to be like single family, like single member family, till they die, all right?
Yeah.
Because children get away from the family, they have their own lives, all right? And sometimes even they don't, like, they divorce, for example.
Yeah.
And there is only one man or a woman living their own separate lives. And when they die, there is nobody with them, sitting with them, or like being just emotionally supportive of the idea. So they were thinking of a community because they belong to a specific church, and they created this kind of community to go to those lonely people just to be with them when they die.
Exactly. Exactly.
You see how subtle it is, you know?
No, it is very important. Like, even, I mean, even from an Islamic perspective, we've been told that if someone is in the process of dying, you need to sit around him, read Quran, comfort him, talk to him, make him feel that you're around, because it's just a process, right? You're moving from one world to another. Mm-hmm. So that process itself is scary, knowing that you're gonna, you know, move over to the next place. Itself is scary, but when you have all your friends around you, all your family, loved ones, it eases that process. Rather than when you're by yourself and you have the agony of death itself and the agony
nobody
of being lonely, right?
Yeah.
It's double agony. So, like I said, it depends on you know, we have the same programs in our hospitals as well. Those who have loved ones, they bring them. If they don't have loved ones, they bring people to comfort you, you know. So because they understand that the process itself is painful, and especially not having anyone around you, having to do it by yourself. So that's obviously, you know, it makes a lot of difference. However, there's also a tiny thing here. As a Muslim, though, even if you're alone, I think you're still at comfort.
Yes.
Do you know why? Because you know where you're going.
Yes.
See, with an atheist, for example, the picture is blurred. Yes. He has no idea where he's going. It's a void. And void itself is scary.
Yes.
When you don't know, you know that you're not going to exist, completely scary. As a mu'min, as a believer, I know I'm going to Allah. I know who's coming to me. I know Malik al-Maut, the angel of death is going to come to my soul. I know where I'm going. And, you know, and I bank on the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Even if I have no one, I can comfort myself with myself.
Yes.
Whether if you don't have that belief system, you're stuck.
Yes. But, brother, alhamdulillah, we don't have that kind of problem. I think we have the opposite problem. There are too many people around. Basically, it's too difficult to even get rid of some of those.
Exactly, exactly. So sometimes we have to get rid of some of the family members and keep some.
Please,
because,
go
away
home.
Because,
you know?
let him breathe, you know.
Yes.
So we have this. Alhamdulillah, this is a blessing.
Yes, alhamdulillah. Thank you very much. Thank you, Sayyid Abdullah. I really enjoyed talking with you. Brother Hussein, I really enjoyed talking with you.
Me too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique. We've been talking about the movie Andover and the concept of cloning and some of its consequences. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
reporters.
Sudan condemns Ethiopia's start of second phase of filling the controversial Nile Dam, warning the move violates existing agreements and threatens security in the region. The warning came after Sudan's Minister of Irrigation and Water Resources received a letter from Ethiopian counterpart informing him of the start of the second filling of the dam during the current rainy season. Despite drums of war appear, the government of Sudan ruled out any military solution to resettle the situation.
I think the military option, to my understanding, is out of question. It's not going to happen, especially for Sudan, because the battle will be in Sudan. And maybe Ethiopia will retaliate if they attack again. Maybe they are going to retaliate in Osir Zam or anywhere else. And the areas there will be affected. So, and this is not the solution.
Experts insist that no other option rather than negotiation within the international law is available for Sudan.
The National Court of Justice, which is an organ of the United Nations, according to its rules, no country can take another country to that court unless the country has already agreed to go before the International Court of Justice, and definitely Syria would not agree to that. So there is no international legal channel available to the government of Sudan.
Last month, Sudan and Egypt had sent a letter asking the UN Security Council to take up the issue. Talks mediated by the African Union most recently in the Democratic Republic of Congo have repeatedly stalled. According to Sudanese authorities, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is being built about 15 kilometers from border with Sudan on the Blue Nile, the source of most of the Nile's water, yet it affects life of 20 million people in this area.
As experts say, with the starting the next phase of filling the controversial mega dam on the Nile River by Ethiopia, the ball is now on the court of Sudan and Egypt. But as things stand, the two countries are still waiting for an action by the UN. Mohammed Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
The anti-Iran Mujahideen-e Khalak organization, considered by many as a dangerous terrorist organization, will hold its annual meeting in Paris on Saturday. The notorious Cairn Academic Edition House, a kind of think tank for universities, published a study about the National Council of Resistance of Iran, NCRI, the umbrella organization of the MKO, with as conclusion, according to objective criteria, the NCRI is without any doubt a sectarian organization. The MKO is, among others, accused of separating children from their parents. So why do French authorities allow them to organize their annual conference?
If Mariam Rajavi is still in France and they still have their rallies every now and then in Paris, it means that the French want to be on both sides of the fence, like all the Europeans. France has an interest of having good relations with Iran. They had Total, which had invested a lot of money then, they'd probably want to go back.
In previous meetings of the MKO in Paris, the group had actively lobbied to obtain the support of mayors and members of parliament. The most visible support comes from French Member of Parliament Habib Meir, who has the double nationality, Israeli and French. He participates even in marches from the MKO here in 2016. Is there a link between Israel and the MKO terrorist organization?
Mujahideen have been linked closely to Israel. You have a report by two high officials from the CIA, which was publicized by NBC Radio in 2012, which said that the operations to assassinate the scientists and any other clandestine operations, terrorist operations inside Iran, were being planned or had been planned by the Israeli Secret Service and executed by members of the Mujahideen. So the Mujahideen have been working with the Israeli Secret Services ever since that time.
Also, important USA officials spoke at the conference. John Bolton, a former USA National Security Advisor, Rudolph Giuliani, former mayor of New York, and they received money. USA speakers received $25,000 French speakers receive $12,500. Media reports say that the money comes from the CIA, from Mossad, but mainly from Saudi Arabia. Experts say that European Union countries, and France in particular, want to eat from both sides. They tolerate the terrorist group on their territory and seek better relations with Iran, especially for economic reasons. It's not sure that this can work. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Among the events that fall in this period is the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the incident. The U.S. and Europe do not recognize the MKO as a terrorist entity and hold regular meetings with the terror group, which is now based in France and Albania.
The MKO terrorists are puppets of the U.S. that have been trying to harm the Islamic Republic since its establishment. They carried out failed assassination of Ayatollah Khamenei when he was president in 1981. They have killed thousands of Iranians in different terrorist attacks, yet the U.S. and Europe delisted them as a terrorist entity and accommodate them. This shows how insincere are the Americans in their human rights slogans.
Activists here believe the U.S. has not changed its hostile behavior toward Iranians. They refer to the ongoing anti-Iran sanctions as economic terrorism that seeks to fulfill the same goals it failed to achieve in the 1980s.
The maximum pressure campaign sought to bring Iranians to their knees to finally pit them against the government. But as you see, this plot has failed, like several other conspiracies they hatched against Iran.
The victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution marked the end of decades of U.S. dominance over Iran's economy and its petroleum sector, something which is believed to be the main reason why the U.S. has made so many attempts to deal a blow to the Islamic Republic, including its support for Iraq in its 8 years of war against Iran and its unconditional support for the anti-Iran MKO terrorist group, and today by unleashing the toughest sanctions that have overshadowed Iran's health sector.
This gathering is held at the former U.S. Embassy in Iran, which is now turned into a museum that showcases documents of Washington's hostile agenda against Iran. Activists here say the U.S. adopts a selective approach towards the issue of human rights, at least in Iran. But they say it's time for the world to know the truth. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An economic crisis came under the spotlight in Lebanon in October 2019 after the then government of Saad Hariri proposed plans to raise new taxes on tobacco, petrol, and voice calls via messaging services such as WhatsApp. The Hariri government sought to drum up more revenue amid a shortage of foreign currency, but the plans led to mass protests against economic turmoil and corruption. Eventually, the plans were called off and the government stepped down, but the financial situation continued to worsen amid the coronavirus pandemic. Hariri's successor, Hassan Diab, also resigned after a deadly explosion at the Beirut port in August 2020 that caused billions of dollars of damage. The Lebanese currency has so far lost more than 90% of its value, and more than half of the population has been sunk into poverty, as the country also faces severe fuel shortages. In the wake of the deepening economic crisis, Diab, who is a caretaker premier now, warned on Tuesday that Lebanon is only days away from what he called a social explosion. Diab, whose country has failed to form a new government in almost 11 months, also urged foreign donors to release financial aid to save the nation and do not link it to the government formation.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
On Monday, the Secretary General of the Hezbollah resistance movement blamed the United States for economic crises. Syed Hassan Nasrallah said Washington is wielding the threat of sanctions against the Lebanese government to prevent it from receiving aid from other countries. Talks over the formation of a new cabinet have stalled as President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri remain at loggerheads over the coming government's makeup and reform agenda. This comes as the U.S. and some of its Western and regional allies are at odds with Beirut over the role of Hezbollah in Lebanon's politics. The resistance movement and its allies now hold the majority of parliamentary seats following elections in 2018. Irrespective of the ongoing crisis in Lebanon, the country's main woes are rooted in the power-sharing system, which is a legacy of the French colonialism. Nonetheless, many are worried that the political vacuum and chaos in Lebanon could plunge the Mediterranean nation into a new civil war like the one it experienced for 15 years until 1990.
Julian Assange recently turned 50 years old inside Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison in London. Despite winning his legal battle against extradition to the United States, he remains incarcerated in the UK's most notorious prison while awaiting the US government's appeal. The WikiLeaks co-founder faces 18 charges, 17 under the Espionage Act, for conspiracy to receive, obtain and disclose classified diplomatic and military documents. But many feel that his real crime was exposing US war crimes to the world. Assange's treatment, which UN Rapporteur Niels Melzer described as psychological torture, has caused outrage back in his native country of Australia, where over 600,000 people have signed a petition calling for his immediate release.
Despite the corporate media running dead on the issue, basically, and not supporting him, there has been a groundswell and there's been a lot of campaigns. There are regular rallies, and of course, but we rely on the social media and other forms of media because the corporate media has been so locked out because they have been in lockstep with all of these 8 wars in the Middle East in the last 20 years.
This also prompted Australian MPs from across the political spectrum to issue a statement via video message to US President Joe Biden to drop the espionage charges against the Australian citizen and for the British government to allow him to return home.
Citizens expect us to protect journalists and publishers, not to imprison them for their work.
So far, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has refused to back campaigners' call for his release and said Assange should not receive, quote, special treatment. Press TV spoke to Australian academic Tim Anderson and asked him what he thought of these comments by the Conservative Prime Minister.
Well, unfortunately, we have a long tradition in Australia of governments kowtowing to Washington, and particularly the Conservative ones. The Conservative ones have been huge enthusiasts for doing whatever Washington wants them to do. So, unfortunately, that's a tradition we live with, and it takes an extraordinary amount of pressure to shift them to lift their fingers and do something that Washington might not agree with. But nevertheless, the pressure is being raised here.
The pressure on Joe Biden's administration to drop the charges against Julian Assange is mounting, with not only Australian MPs demanding his release, but also Italian parliamentarians calling for the recognition of his political refugee status. But will any of this sway the US, who seem as determined as ever to extradite the co-founder of WikiLeaks? Ahmed Kabbala, London.
Violence has escalated in Afghanistan since the official declaration in May by US President Joe Biden to withdraw remaining American troops from Afghanistan by September 11. Since then, the Taliban have intensified their attacks on hundreds of district centers across the country, many of these dramatically falling into the hands of the militant group one after another across the nation.
The situation is getting worse day by day. The Taliban have captured several districts and are expanding their hold on most of highways now under their control. Northern provinces are also the scene of a rise in Taliban attacks, but government forces are not confronting them seriously.
Despite Taliban's advance, government officials have described the fall of those districts into the hands of militants as an outcome of a tactical retreat by Afghan troops who have no much support of foreign forces on the ground now. However, the Taliban militant group seemingly doesn't care about what officials in Kabul talks about the reasons of the fall of dozens of districts. Instead, the group is still trying to bring more lands under its sway. But things seem to be not in favor of the Taliban as they expect because of prevailing public anger, as because many Afghans are against the revival of the Taliban rule over the country due to the group's dogmatic ideology, especially when it comes to social liberties. As a matter of fact, locals have formed armed fronts to resist Taliban attacks.
We support public resistance fronts against the Taliban. There is no doubt these forces have created serious obstacles on the way of Taliban and stopping them from gaining more ground. They will defeat the Taliban in close cooperation with our army and police forces if the government honestly supports them.
The move has been fruitful as public uprising forces have retaken several key districts from the Taliban, mainly in northern Tahar and southern Ghazni provinces. The back-to-back fall of districts to the Taliban has also created doubts among locals who say the retreat of Afghan forces from some key districts is unusual. The doubts have raised concerns of a strong revival of Taliban and their possible secret deals. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
During a conference held by media outlets and attended by media, political, and academic figures, Lebanon's Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lauded the work of the press, especially in its coverage of the last round of fighting in Al-Quds battle. Said Nasrallah began by stressing that the media is a partner in all victories and needs to focus on where the confrontation lies and with whom.
We cannot liberate Palestine without breaking the U.S. hegemony in our region. This hegemony provides the Zionist regime with all required means for its survival. Only 12 days into the Al-Quds battle, the Zionist regime called for aid from the U.S. Therefore, in our discourse, we cannot exclude the U.S. role in the region.
Sayed Nasrallah highlighted the points of strength of the resistance media, which he says the rival media lacks: honesty, integrity, and the mere fact of backing a righteous cause and facing injustice makes the media of the resistance more reliable, according to the leader of the resistance. The broadcast networks at the conference agreed that there is much work to be done. Some experts at the conference believed the media should develop to the extent that it becomes makers of news and writers of the discourse.
Reviewing the literature accumulated since the world wars and the modern-day conflicts, we always see a discourse in the making. Resistance media have raised the standards of news writing. Today, our media are not just the transmitters of the news.
Experts at law also spoke at the conference, suggesting that there needs to be a focus on the war crimes of the Israeli entity, while focusing on legal terminology.
The crimes that Israel commits against Palestinians, the crimes are really crimes against humanity and all kinds of crime. Israel should really be punished for what is she pursuing and what is she committing against Palestinians and Israel. It's the occupation is illegal by law, by international law, and this is why on the other side it's very legal for the Palestinian to fight for their freedom, to free Palestine, to free Palestine and to free the people of Palestine.
The meetings concluded with an emphasis on highlighting the regional equation of protecting Jerusalem al-Quds from any Israeli aggression. The conference today brings together tens of media outlets which consider themselves in alliance with the resistance forces in the region and speak on their behalf. Sayed Nasrallah has given his blessings to the men and women in this field while also calling on them to reinvent and strengthen their media discourse. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The latest Israeli airstrike over the Gaza Strip has left several families homeless. In northern parts of the enclave, tents have replaced high-rise buildings leveled by Israeli airstrike. Abu Muhammad, a father of 11 children, has his three-story building bombed. He is now living with his family in his damaged home with nowhere to go.
They bombed our house with no prior notice. We had to escape the streets, leaving all of our belongings in the house. People helped us and offered shelter in armed wire schools. When the war was over, some people went back to their homes, but I felt miserable because I had nowhere to go. We have no way but to live in the tents.
Ala, a Gazan student, has all her belongings damaged when the Israeli regime bombed their home. She is now not able to pursue her studies due to the chaos she is caught in.
We thought we were secured in our home, but they hit us. When I got back here to see what happened to the home,